All right, this is Greek in Plain English, class 14, the final night. We've got three basic things I want to just cover this evening as we wrap things up. I want to go over a little bit of the lexicon that's in the notebooks and just take a look at a few of the words. I want to talk about how some Semitic ideas or thoughts kind of crept into the Greek of the New Testament. And then I want to take a look at just a couple of extra resources that that I think we should have that I've been talking about. And I finally actually did my homework and found them on Amazon with their ISBN numbers and everything. So I will not mumble around when I'm talking about them here. In the notebook, one of the last sections, towards the very end, is an example of a few things where we see a Semitic thought impacting on the Greek. No language is isolated from any other language. English is a great example of that. We come out of the, we're in the Indo-European language family. We come out of the Germanic strain. But you see early on with Old English and whatnot, there's all this influence in there. And even today, our language is influenced. We, you know, if you look at English, it has some Latin influences, it has German influences, it has, there is some Greek words, there's words that we've made up in the style of Latin and Greek, mainly technical words. We have foreign words all the time. Interestingly, culturally within a language is that you may find these additions to the language within smaller areas. Here within the Southern California area, particularly around LA and whatnot, you find a crossover between English and Spanish a lot. I once had two folks that I asked to teach me some Spanish that I worked with, and the one person grew up in East L.A., spoke Spanish at home. The other had gone to college to study Spanish formally because their goal was to be a translator, ideally at like the U.N., that kind of place. And so they had a very formal thing, and they got into an argument one day over how to teach me how to say I'm going to lunch. And the person with the formal education said, well, in Spanish, the midday meal is called almuerzo. And the other gal that had grown up, you know, in a family in East L.A. said, no, it's alunche. And so you have this sort of crossover between the word lunch in English and in Spanish. And so it is normal that we have these kind of things. And we have to recognize them because we can't treat any one language as purely isolated in and of itself. It's not in a little petri dish there in the lab. It's language is living and it's going to interact with stuff. And Greek did that. Greek interacted with other languages that were floating around at the time. And particularly, the authors of the New Testament were all Jewish. Okay, that I'll take a moment here on that. The general thought is that all of the authors of the New Testament were Jewish, with the exception of Luke. I am in the very tiny slice of the pie that believes that Luke was Jewish as well, although probably an extremely Hellenistic Jew, but still Jewish as well. Most folks hang the debate on whether Luke was a Gentile or not over the end of the book of Colossians. And in Colossians at the very end, Paul is talking about his team. And he says, he's thanking everyone. He talks about Tychicus and Aristarchus. And then he says, and Jesus, who is called Justice, also sends greeting. In terms of, and depending on what your translation says, it's the underlying Greek text there is those of the circumcision. Paul says, in terms of those of the circumcisions, there are only the fellow workers of the kingdom, and they've been a comfort to me. And so he mentions this group as being of the circumcision. And then a verse or two later, he then goes on to talk about Demas and Luke, the physician. And so the general thought is that they were they're separated out. If they're not this part of the group of the circumcision, therefore Luke must be a Gentile. The structure of that particular verse is interesting in that it really could be taken a couple of different ways. You could be taken to understand that those are the only believing Jews who ever helped Paul, which I think is kind of extreme. But that's the way most folks take it because they exclude Luke and Demas. Or it could be said that those were the group within the circumcision who helped him. Remember that Paul uses this phrase, the circumcision, sometimes negatively to talk about those Jews who attacked him for and the other believing Jews, the Judaizers. And so it could be that Paul is saying, look, of that group, it was just these guys that came over to help me, but we've got all these other people. And this whole section at the end of Colossians is a little bit difficult sledding anyway. The reference to Laodicea and Nympha. Nympha is interesting. In the Greek, depending on where the accent falls, it's either a masculine or a feminine name. When Paul wrote Colossians, they didn't put accents in the word. Accents are a very modern thing for the Greek text for the New Testament. So, you know, you pay your money and you take your choice at that one. If there was an accent, do you put it, you know, one part of the word and make it a masculine name? If you put it on the other words, a feminine name. A lot of translations translate it feminine, Nympha in the church that meets in her house. The scribes that actually copied the New Testament, they would make a choice. And if they put the accent to make it a masculine name, then they would change the pronoun to be his house. If they made the accent to make it a feminine name, they would change the pronoun to be her house, because there always has to be agreement in Greek. And so, again, you know, it's a text-critical issue. You know, you have to look at it and make a decision. There were no accents originally, so we're not sure whether Nympha was a guy or a gal. And so there's enough ambiguity at the end of Colossians here in this section that I'm not comfortable directly saying that out of all the authors of the New Testament, there's just this one guy, Luke, who wasn't a Jew. I'm a little more comfortable thinking that, well, he probably was a very Hellenized Jew. But again, that position is an extremely tiny slice of the pie. And there are some folks who I've said that to who get very upset with me and just tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about and I think forfeit anything else that I say because of that one little point. So because I said the whole New Testament was written by Jews, I need to say that. But even if that's true that Luke was a Gentile, then 99% of the New Testament authors were Jewish. And we would expect that we would see influences of Semitic language in the way they did things. One of the main things we see is that they occasionally shove the verb as the first word in a phrase or a clause, which is a very representative thing of Hebrew. Hebrew is a verb subject object order, and so we see that if you look in Luke does this. Interestingly enough, those that claim that Luke is a Gentile, Luke is one of the examples of this. If you look in 1 Timothy, you'll see these things where the verb is shoved up to the front of the sentence or clause. Another thing that happens is the extensive use of chi. In Hebrew, they use this conjunction. Vav, to connect or introduce phrases in Hebrew. So much so that if you read old translations of the Old Testament, you find this phrase, and it came to pass, over and over again. Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, makes the joke about the Book of Mormon, because the Book of Mormon reads very close to the King James, almost as if it was copied. Mark Twain, in his book, I think it's in Roughing It, which if you haven't read Mark Twain, it's not at all about Greek here, but if you haven't read Mark Twain's Roughing It, you really need to go out and buy that. It's just the best piece of American literature. Anyway, he references the Book of Mormon and says, if you took out all the "and it came to passes," the thing would just be a pamphlet. And that idea of "and it came to pass," that vav connection in the Hebrew, we find in a lot of Greek with this use of chi. Mark does it all the time. You go through Mark and he just has chi, 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 and, which is a very Hebrew kind of thing to do. Redundant prepositions. The other one is saying. You'll find this all the time. And he said, saying, that's a very common Semitic structure. And you find that throughout the New Testament. And what this means is that we just have to, when all the begatting, all the egeneta and egeneto in the genealogies, you have to allow that this is just part of how they thought. You know, it's just part of how they wrote. I suspect that when I write my blog post each week, before I send it to my editor, you know, I'm writing like this Southern California native. I mean, that's just how I write. If I lived outside of London and had been schooled at Oxford or Cambridge, I would probably have a different style. So just like this, the authors in the New Testament, first century Jews who speak Greek, who have that Semitic influence. So you're going to find some of these things in the text. And that's okay. I mean, that's kind of the cool part of it. Parallelisms, a lot of parallelisms, which are very common in Hebrew poetry. So as you go through the New Testament, you may see some things that aren't pure, perfect, accurate Greek. And that's really just they're really a lot of the Semitic influence within the text. There are whole tomes written about that if you're interested. You can go out and find all kinds of doctoral dissertations and all kinds of stuff on little tiny pieces of this, you know, the use of egeneta and the use of chi. You know, you find these. So if you're interested in that, that's kind of fascinating. But it's another way that languages are kind of, you know, expanding and contracting and changing. The New Testament is the same thing. Okay, speaking of words then, let's take a look through this lexicon. I went through, and this is really, it's in order, alphabetical order, but it's based on what I think. It's sort of, I kind of went through and I said, okay, you know, here are a bunch of words that I think would be good for you to know. Most of these are high-frequency words that you're going to find. Again, Metzger's lexical aids take the words and give them to you in their frequency. And so that certainly is a really good a reference book. But if you have the notes in this class, you get my lexicon. You'll notice that I tried to give you the lexical range of the words here. That's not necessarily in the... If I have, like, for agiadzo, you know, I have for the first definition, I say set aside something or make it suitable for ritual purposes, consecrate, dedicate. The third definition is to treat as holy. The fourth definition is to eliminate that which is incompatible with holiness. So you see that there's a range there. It doesn't mean that the fourth definition is used less frequently than the first, although the first one is probably the most common, but you can see that I'm just trying to give you the range there of the word. Hagios, which is related to agiazo, is as an adjective it means holy or sacred. As a noun, it means saint. We are the hagioi. So you can see those words are closely related. For Adelphus, I actually gave you the literal, because remember I'd spoken of that one point in here, that it actually is a compound word. It's a comparative alpha on the front, and so it's from the same womb, a brother. If we change it, oh, and I noticed, just looking at this, I didn't change the font there. My apologies. That strange-looking word there is actually Adelphé, but without the proper font. And that just means sister. It's the same thing. It's just Greek changes for that word. They change the ending the ending letter, because again, it goes from a first declension noun, from a second declension noun to a first. You can see some of these. Adikaya is unrighteousness, wickedness. That's an alpha privative on the word for righteous, dikaios. So adikaya is alpha privative. It is not righteous. It is unrighteous. Let's see. Ion is a long period of time. That's usually age. We see that a lot in the text. On the second page of the lexicon, Allah, that is not the Arabic word. It means but or except. Frequently, you'll see the A dropped off the end. So it'll just be alpha, lambda, lambda with a little like apostrophe there. So if you see that, it's the same word. It's just because, again, Greek ears didn't like to hear those vowels going over into other vowels, so that's why that drops off. Harmatia is sin. When we study sin in college, in a seminary, you study harmatiology, which is the study of sin. I looked forward to that class in seminary because I knew I'd get a really good grade in the homework. Those jokes are much better with a rim shot. I'm trying to think of anything else there. Apostello, we get the word apostle. It really just means to be sent out. One who's sent out, but sent out with a purpose. So often, words in the Greek text have become technical words for us in English. Apostle to us is sort of this it's a job title. Oh, that guy's an apostle. It's the job title he had in the New Testament. Well, yes, that's true. But the problem is we've taken and codified a word that had meaning. The apostles were the ones who were chosen for a purpose to be sent out. They're the ones sent out on a purpose. And when we make it a job title, something that, you know, a John would put on his business card, I think we rob some of the meaning of the text. The same thing is with angelos, angel. We say angel, but it really is messenger. It's a messenger from God. That's what angels did. They showed up to bring messages throughout the Bible, not just the New Testament. Baptizo, boy, that's a heavily loaded word for us. It means baptize. I mean, it even sounds like our English word baptize. Ceremonial washing for purification, to use water in a rite for the purpose of establishing a relationship to God. That's how we normally view Christian baptism. But it can also be an extraordinary experience. Not every time you see baptizo in the New Testament does it mean water baptism. And that's a very quick way to get into a fight amongst people of different denominations, is to bring up baptism. You know, you can sprinkle, you can dunk, you could 24-hour Martinize. You know, there's a variety of ways of doing it, but not every passage in the New Testament means water baptism. Many of the references to baptism that we find means a common, extraordinary experience. It points to when people become believers. So it points to that moment of justification, not water baptism. You know, there's only two beliefs within the broader Christian range of denominations. It's that either that baptism is necessary for salvation, or that baptism is something that is done after salvation occurs as a covenant with God. Those are the only two views you can have, and you can go anywhere you want within the panoply of Christian denominations, and everybody will fall into one of those two categories. And if you hold one, you deride and exclude everybody who holds the other position, because Christians are great at dividing. That's one of our great skill sets. And so, and you immediately, whatever position you hold on baptism, whenever you read the word baptism in the text, you immediately think that it pertains to your view. You should not do that. You should let the word baptizo mean what it means within the context of the passage, even if it doesn't agree with what your particular view is. I'm trying to think if there are other words here that are that are big standout words. Diakonia is service, diakonos. We get our modern word deacon from that in church. Deacons are the ones that serve. Again, great arguments over ecclesiology, the study of the church, as to the roles of people in churches, their jobs within the church. The word for elder, the word for deacon, are those different things? Are those similar things? It appears that they are in Paul's writing, because he gives two criteria separate for each of those. But again, in some denominations, deacons function as elders. The board of deacons is essentially like another church's board of elders. These, by the way, are all modern arguments based on semantics. They're not arguments from the text. And you always just have to make sure that if you're dealing with a modern semantic argument, that you don't try to force the text to go where that is. The text must always be the main thing. It doesn't mean that what you're doing is incorrect or whatnot. We have huge latitude through our freedom in Christ to do things. I mean, to do church, to do the ordinances or the sacraments. We have huge wiggle room on that stuff. But again, we have to be careful not to force the text where it doesn't go. I've already talked about doulos. A slave in the New Testament is not the same thing as a slave in the United States of America. It is almost impossible for us to think of the word slave and not have the connotation of slavery in America. I just don't think it's possible for us to do that. But when you read the New Testament, that term doulos, that term slave, is not the same. Slavery, certainly within this time period, could be as brutal and ugly and terrible as the slavery was here in the United States, but it could be different. You know, if you happen to be a doctor or a highly respected tradesperson, and let's say the Roman army came in and captured your village or whatnot, you would be sold as a slave, but you would go into the household, often of a nobleman, because they had the money to purchase you, and you would be accorded quite a nice life, because you were the family doctor. You were the highly skilled tradesperson that served that family. So, you know, you wouldn't be brutalized. If you were just kind of a run-of-the-mill guy, or let's say military or whatnot, then all the kind of movie images of slavery, where you're locked in the dungeon beneath the Colosseum and, you know, all this stuff, then that did become... But we have to be careful with doulos not to... And it's particularly bad for us here in the U.S. I'm trying to think what else. Zoe, that's huge in John's Gospel. Ethnos, there's an interesting word. Ethnos means a nation, or it can mean Gentiles. And you really have to be careful what the meaning is there. Are they talking about all the world, or are they talking about just the Gentiles? Remember, Jesus was the promised Messiah of Israel. He came to Israel. Israel rejected him in the kingdom, and so his finished work on the cross, he created a new body, which was all, it was a combination of all Jewish believers and all Gentile believers into this new body. That's the mystery of the church. That's what Paul teaches us in Ephesians. But this use of the idea of Gentiles versus Jews, you know, there, you know, like in Paul's idea, you really had three groups of people. You had non-Jewish believers, I'm sorry, Jewish non-believers. You had believers, the church. And then you had Gentiles. And so sometimes we just have to be careful when we read these passages that use ethnos to determine whether the author is talking about going to the Gentiles, or whether they're talking in a broader situation of an entire nation, or an area outside of the general area of where, the Mediterranean and Middle East. So that's a word you have to look at occasionally. Euangelizo is, that's our modern, that's the word we use for gospel. It just means to announce the good news, but it's that word comes over as gospel for us. I stuck theos in there. That's probably one of the most well-known Greek words ever, that and logos. But I just told you that was God in case you didn't know. Let's see what else. Chi, I always use chi as my reference to how poorly first-year Greek students learn their vocabulary. Chi has, and I only put three of the meanings. It has a wider range than this, but it's and, even, or also. But everybody, and myself included in this, when I first learned chi, I learned just and. And you know, you go through a couple of years translating every time you see chi as and you go, why doesn't my translation work here? And it's like, well, you knucklehead, you forgot that there's a couple other definitions for chi. So chi can have a broader lexical range than just and. Cardia means heart, the actual physical heart. But remember, in the physiology of antiquity, your torso contained more than just the sum of your parts. I mean, it wasn't just your intestines and your stomach and your lungs and whatnot. In antiquity, it was your heart was viewed as sort of the seat of your emotions. In the New Testament, that period of time, and in the Old Testament as well, we talk about your guts. Splagna is the Greek word. I love that word. Splagna is the Greek word for guts. And it's technically your intestines, you know, your colon and your small intestines, whatnot. But that was viewed as an emotional seat in the body. There was a, you know, I mentioned this after class a week or so ago, that there's a great old translation of the passage in the Bible, and his bowels were spilled. Well, it just meant that he was just like gushing out emotionally, but it just sounds terrible in English, right? So we have to understand sort of in the physiology of antiquity, they saw the heart as the seat of emotions. They saw your guts, your stomach, and your intestines as seat of emotions and whatnot. So sometimes when you see this word cardia, realize that it may not just mean, you know, your heart itself. Koinonia is a word that Christians use all the time. It's what they name their small groups and coffee and donut meetings as. And because it means fellowship, and we all know koinonia means fellowship, but to think that koinonia in the New Testament meant having coffee and donuts and talking about who got picked in the NFL draft is probably not the best idea of what that word meant. Fellowship meant that there was a close association. You were brothers. You were bonded together through common beliefs and common practice. And yes, fellowship did occur around a meal or around an activity. But that idea of koinonia goes, it's not just having a social event or a food event. It has to do with that close-knit brotherhood that you get from sharing common beliefs and practices. If we use it in a verbal sense, it means I'm sharing with you, I'm interacting with you, but it's always within that context of a common group. It does not just mean coffee and donuts, no matter how often they tell you that in the bulletin of your church. A cosmos, I've already talked about that. Cosmos has a huge lexical range. It can mean everything from everything, the entire created universe, down to... Actually, in 1 Peter, it's describing women's makeup and jewelry and hair. It's women's fashion, and so you have to cosmos. You have to be so careful with on that to understand what that means. When we were talking about John 3:16, the past two classes, you know, if you are a person who holds to limited atonement, to a traditional five-point Calvinist view, you will see cosmos there in a very narrow sense. Some folks who are really very strongly holding the 5 points of Calvinism will see that cosmos there really only refers to the church, only to believers. If you do not hold that sort of a position, you may see cosmos as being much more. Certainly, you know... those Christians who are more inclined to a more of a New Agey openness kind of feel will expand cosmos to mean everything. You know, butterflies and water lilies get to go to heaven as well. So we know that all dogs go to heaven. If they ever make a movie about cats, then we'll know that as well. That's probably the worst question, and I get asked this every couple of years. I have somebody, the Sunday school class I teach, the adult Sunday school class. I would expect it from kids, but every couple of years, the adult Sunday school class, I always will have, it'll come up, and somebody will say, well, what happens to my pets when I die? And that's a tough question, and so I always tell them, well, the movies tell us that all dogs go to heaven, and we're not sure about hamsters and cats and whatnot. But fortunately, the New Testament is completely silent on that, so I have no answer. So if anybody wonders that, you should probably call Hadavar, and maybe they have something on it, but it's not in the New Testament. I think logos. Logos is another one of those words that has a wide lexical range. Sometimes it just means speech, and it's often paired with the word rhema, which means word. And other times it means a philosophical concept way beyond just human words. It is definitely used by John to refer to Jesus, to the second person of the Trinity. And so it has a wide lexical range. It was very common in Greek philosophy within the literature. It was really, where it really took off was in the second century, a Greek apologist who, you know, Christianity started out as a fractional movement out of Judaism. I mean, all the first Christians were Jewish. The Bible teaches us that the Jews were the first Christians, and then the Samaritans were added in, and then the Gentiles after that. That's the order that you go through in the book of Acts. Jewish believers first, Samaritan believers second, and then Gentile believers. And so predominantly the church early on was all Jewish. And then you got more Gentiles and more Gentiles and more Gentiles until you finally hit the tipping point where now you had more Gentiles than you had Jews. And finally, because of the work of Rome in destroying Jerusalem and eliminating the temple and dispersing and killing the Jews, and really after the Bar Kokhba uprising in 145, that the dominant original sort of rabbinic Judaism was gone. It was primarily a Greco-Roman world, and the majority of Christians were Greeks and Romans. And the way that they had to start explaining Christianity to folks who weren't Christians, both to defend the faith as well as to bring others in, couldn't be the same way. You couldn't go talk about, but don't you see, on Yom Kippur, you know, we had the sacrifice on the altar. Well, that wouldn't make sense to a guy who never understood Judaism, never knew the temple was there any practice. So the second century apologists started to use Greek philosophical terms to represent the meanings of what were originally Jewish in origin. And so that's when the logos really took off. That was good in the respect that the sovereignty of God made sure that Christianity didn't die as a small fraction of Jewish religion. It was bad in that it started taking Christianity away from its Jewish roots. And it started making Christianity something that it wasn't. It made it more philosophical and more Greek. And it really wasn't. Just like one of the worst, I'm pontificating here at this point. One of the worst things that ever happened to Christianity was when it became the official religion of Rome, when Constantine did that. Because now that removed it further from its origins. So this word logos, to cycle back here, really it came out a lot with the early 2nd century apologists. But within the New Testament, we know that it points frequently to the figure of Jesus. Let's see. Makarios. Makarios is an interesting word. That's in the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the, and as we all know from Monty Python, blessed are the cheesemakers, right? That's actually a very funny little bit that Monty Python does on that. But this word of blessed is directly connected over to the Old Testament to the idea of blessing that we see in the Psalms. You look at Psalm 1, and that word there, in fact, for blessed that's in Psalm 1, when it was translated into the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, came across as makarios. So we see that that word blessed, when we see it in the New Testament, points us back to that idea of being blessed out of the Old Testament. So that's a real strong crossover there that you should see. Let's see, what else? Hadas, way, a road or journey, that's actually what Christianity was called early on. Christianity used to be called the way. I always laugh, there's an interesting parallel. I am not at all implying that Christianity is at all like an Eastern philosophy, but the sort of the indigenous philosophy out of China, Taoism, is called the way. And it always cracked me up that you read the New Testament, Christianity is called the way. You read the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu, and it's called the way. So it's one of those interesting parallels in the world where you have two things with the same way. So frequently you'll see that hadas referring to the practice of Christianity, to those who are members of the church. So that's another one that has a couple of different ways of looking at it. Peripateo, Paul uses that all the time. It means to walk. It literally means to walk, but it's a metaphor for how you live. When Paul says, don't walk in the way of blah, 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 that means don't live like sinners or unrepentant Gentiles. When Paul says, walk in this way, he is not quoting Aerosmith. He is pointing to how we should live our life. We are to walk in a certain way. We are to live in a certain manner. So you find peripateo to be used metaphorically a great deal. Let's see. Sarx is another one. Sarx, the common definition is flesh, but the word flesh is used so many different ways in the New Testament. I gave you four different views of sarx. Flesh meaning literally muscle or skin. It could be representative of the entire human body. It can represent the human condition. In other words, what it is to be human, not just, you know, the actual physical body. But it also is the you know, we talk about the interior life. It's what we have in our mind and in our heart. And then we have the outward life. It's kind of how we are out in public. Sarx references that difference as well. So that's another word. You have to be careful of the lexical range on that. Soma is another one that refers to the body. Usually flesh is used more. Soma's literally just the body. And soma could also be an animal as well, so it could refer to an animal's body. Soteria, that means salvation, that means saved. There's a word that has, a wide lexical range. Paul uses it three different ways. Paul uses it to refer to saving you from actual physical death. I was saved. I didn't die. John uses that as well. Paul uses saved as justification. When we trust in Christ for eternal life, when we are justified, that's salvation. Paul uses it that way. It's also used in the New Testament talking about sanctification. Remember, the New Testament teaches two different things. It teaches justification, which is the moment you trust in Christ for eternal life. You have eternal life at that point. Sanctification is the process that takes place after that, where the Holy Spirit works in you to make you more Christ-like. Justification is eternal. It never ends. Sanctification goes up to the point of death, and then God takes over after that. We are glorified at some point. So, but the word saved, this soteria, is used sometimes to talk about sanctification. If you get those passages mixed up, it will really mess up your theology. And there are a couple of passages where you have to be real honest and say, what does this mean? In James, he talks about knowledge that will save a soul from death. What does that mean, that will save a soul? Is he talking about salvation there? Or is he talking about saving a person from physical death? You got to be real careful with that. That's a situation where it is so easy to let our theology that we know and practice influence how we understand the text. So you have to look at what the text says, and only then can you develop your theology. And you have to be sometimes. You have to be comfortable that it says something different than what you might have been taught, and you got to kind of tweak it at that point. Not the text, what you've been taught. Tis and te, you have to be careful of. Without an accent over the iota, it means someone or something. With an accent over the iota, it means who, what, which, or why. Big difference in your translation. Because in this class you're working out of an interlinear text, you'll have the translation there. But just that's one you have to look out for. Everything else, charis, grace, suke is most commonly the soul. Again, it becomes a technical word at that point to talk about that immaterial part of your body. The Bible teaches that the human body that the humans have two parts. We have a material part and we have an immaterial part. Some folks believe that the Bible teaches we have three parts, body, soul, and spirit. To me, it's easier to view it as two parts, material, immaterial, and the immaterial could be broken down into multiple parts, soul and spirit. But psuche is usually referring to that immaterial part. Again, if you're in theology, if you're studying systematic theology, there's a great deal of discussion on whether we are bipartite or tripartite. And Garsh, both sides argue strongly for their view, and they can point out every single verse of the New Testament that proves their view to be correct. But in general, the New Testament clearly shows two parts. Well, the Bible itself. The thing the Bible shows is that those two parts, material and immaterial, are completely joined together. You can't separate them. What affects your immaterial part affects your material part. What affects your material part affects your immaterial part. That's common sense for human beings. We understand if emotionally we're struggling, physically we struggle as well. The Bible teaches the same thing. That's what's so difficult about death, is it's a rending of those two things, a radical ripping of those two things apart. The material part then dies, New Testament teaches. The immaterial part is present with God. We know at some point at the end, the Bible teaches, that the material part and the immaterial part will then be joined together again, and we will have resurrection bodies. I'm sort of hoping for my resurrection body to be kind of like how I was when I was about 25. I think I looked my best. It's probably doing good then. So I'm hoping that resurrection body comes out about like that. So suke then, just realize that is not just the technical word for soul. Okay, one last thing here to finish up. I have rambled on a couple of weeks about books, and I have said, oh, I don't know the name. I think the author's this. So I actually went home and dug through my bookcase and wrote these down and looked up their ISBN numbers, because I don't want anyone to think that I have not done due diligence for this process. There's three sets of resources here. One is diagramming and exegesis, one is grammar resources, and the other one is a general biblical exegesis aid. I will make these part of the notes in future versions of this class. We talked about sentence diagramming past 2 weeks. The two books that I just really find good on this are Principles and Practice of Greek Exegesis by Grasmick and Diagrammatical Analysis by Kantenwein. Now, I love Principles and Practice of Greek Exegesis. The easiest way to get that book is to go online for the Dallas Theological Seminary bookstore. Okay, that book is used in class there. Grasmick was there at DTS. Those were his notes that he taught for the class. You can find it on Amazon from other sellers, but if you go directly to to the Dallas Theological Seminary bookstore, it's like $9. If you go on Amazon, it's like $30. So, and you will be underwhelmed when you see the book. It is not a fancy, shiny, hardcover, beautiful graphics, you know, holographic images or anything. It looks like basically it was Xeroxed off and glued into a softbound cover. But it is one of the best books you're going to get on diagramming. And the front part of it, he talks about real briefly, but it's profound. It's how you should be as a human being when you're going as your spiritual life, how it should be when you're approaching exegesis. It's really wonderful. I can't say enough good things about the book. Diagram Grammatical Analysis by Canton Wine deals with both Greek and Hebrew diagramming. Grassman's book is only Greek diagramming. Canton Wine's book is slightly more complex. It looks better because it's officially typeset, but it's a little bit more complex. Grammar resources. There is a great little book, a paperback book, very small. It's about the size of an old pocketbook. Not very many pages. There's only 100, maybe a little more than that, called English Grammar to Ace New Testament Greek. Great book. It sort of summarizes a lot of the stuff we've talked about in this class. It's a wonderful little book with examples, and it just, again, it's taking concepts of grammar and syntax and linguistics and putting it in a way that you say, this is what English does, and now this is kind of where Greek differs. Another book, It's Still Greek to Me by David Allen Black. This book is supposed to be an intermediate book. It's supposed to be the book that you read after you've taken first year Greek. But it's a great book, and I'm a huge fan of David Allen Black. I just think this guy is great, and so I really like that book. It may be slightly more advanced than this class, but it's just a good book, and it's written in a way that's fairly easy to navigate. The last one is one of my favorite Greek grammars, and I think I may have put this in the as one of the reference books for this class. I did not. Wow, I'm surprised by that. I'll have to add it in. It is called Greek Grammar, and it's a grammar of classical Greek by Smythe, Herbert Weir Smythe. And it is my favorite non-biblical grammar for Greek. It's just wonderful. And it's old. It's an old-timey grammar. But it's again, I use it a tremendous amount. It's a great book. So, but it's a grammar, and it's written back when grammars weren't meant to be bestsellers. It was written when grammars to be grammars. It's very academic, but it is along with Mounce's Basics of Biblical Greek. I would recommend Smythe's Greek Grammar as well. And because it's old and fairly common, it's not super expensive. Okay, the last book is a book that's not so much about Greek. Although it does talk about Greek, it talks about Hebrew as well. But it's this really wonderful book on biblical exegesis, because the whole point of what we do, the whole point of all this Greek stuff, or if this was a class in Hebrew, is not just to learn another language. As cool as that might make you when you're hanging out with your friends at a club to say that I know a classical language, which nobody speaks anymore, we're doing this for a purpose, and the purpose is understanding the Bible better. I mean, that's the whole purpose of this. It's not just to learn the language. If you were going to learn another language, there are other languages that are much more fun and enjoyable probably than banging through a language that's, you know, 2,000 or more years old. But because of what we're doing is to learn the Bible better, to be better at exegesis, I love this book just for that. It's called Figures of Speech Used in the Bible. It's by a guy named Bullinger. It is a very old book. Been around for a long, long time. It is the best book you're going to have for understanding any figure of speech that occurs in the Bible, Old Testament or New Testament. And he's so incredibly thorough in this. He will give you all the examples of where this figure of speech occurs. He'll give you the huge, big linguistic grammar word for it. You know, he says hypocatastasis. He doesn't say it's a type of you know, a coded metaphor. He says it's hypocatastasis. So you get all the big words in there. But it is an excellent book. It's you know, my copy is dog-eared and it's hardcover. They now have a softcover versions of these, paperback versions. But I would strongly recommend that book. Again, it's not an expensive book. It's been around for a long time. The most of the citations in the book are, I think, all King James, maybe Revised Standard Version. It's, you're not going to, well, maybe they've redone it with NIV or NASB or something, but you know, you'll be seeing the quotes from the Bible in it will be older translations, because this book's been around for a while. But it is an excellent book for helping you do exegesis of the text. Okay, we have covered everything we need to do. We have learned all we can possibly stuff our little heads with full of Greek. So now the following thing from this would be that you would find a first-year Greek class, you know, at a Bible college, a seminary. Some junior colleges, I think, actually have a Koine Greek class, as I've been told. I haven't seen any, but that would be the next step from this, and it's sort of a more formal way to take everything we've done. But that pretty much does it for Greek in plain English.